The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Drug addiction continues to be a problem in this country and other parts of the world. The amazing fact is that you may not know that you're living with an addiction problem and that the drugs in question may be in your own home. This is Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. Brad has been on the front lines of addiction and will share the wisdom he's discovered along with guest experts and those who have lived through it or are living through it right now. Here's your host, Bradley DeHaven.
Welcome to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven. And if you'd like to reach me, you can do so at my website, which is rxdrugaddict.com. You can also like me on Facebook at Afflicted by Addiction. And I hope that you'll contact me, particularly if you have show guests that you think would help benefit education, awareness, and reform of this epidemic that's now sweeping our country. Today, I'm going to be joined by two professionals in the business, a doctor and a lady that is knee-deep in naloxone. And naloxone, we're going to explain to you what that is, but I'm joined by Dr. Sharon Stancliffe. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Whitney Englander. Welcome, Whitney.
Thank you.
So before we get started, I always ask my guests a question, which is based on the title of my show. And we'll start with Whitney Englander first. And Whitney, are you afflicted by addiction?
Am I afflicted by addiction? I am very proud to be a person in long-term recovery. It is because of my recovery that for over 8 years I have not had to have a drink or a drug. Because of that, I'm a mother. I'm a mother to a wonderful toddler with one on the way in about a week. I'm a wife. I'm a sister, and I've also had the privilege of really pursuing a career in government relations. I have served my local congressman in Washington, D.C., and through both the Harm Reduction Coalition and through recovery advocacy and parity implementation, I've had the opportunity to work with Congress, federal agencies, and the administration to pursue policies that promote harm reduction and public health responses to the issue of addiction.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, talk about somebody that has a success story there. You know, we try to pass on hope, and this show, Afflicted by Addiction, is really the voice of Americans. And I interview people from all over the United States, whether they are politicians, and I know you've worked in the government, or parent activists who have paid the ultimate price and lost a child to addiction and have sprung up a grassroots effort to try to raise awareness and education in their community or even bigger, and even recovering drug addicts and drug dealers who tell us, kind of give us the keys to the kingdom and tell us the secrets of how this darkness all begins. So it's so important to get the voices on there also of professionals and people like yourself in recovery, but also in this world of trying to make this a better thing. So thank you for all that you do, Whitney.
Thank you.
Now, let's go on to Dr. Stancliffe. Dr. Stancliffe, your resume is about as long as my leg, and I will tell you that Dr. Stancliffe is a medical director for the Harm Reduction Coalition, and Whitney is also involved in the coalition. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Stancliffe, I'm going to ask you the same exact question. Are you afflicted by addiction?
I think, first of all, it's the Harm Reduction Coalition, maybe getting mixed up with HAMS.
Oh, I'm sorry. My reading glasses.
Right. I mean, I think that my career has been shaped by my response to the addictions I've seen, both professionally and personally. First, I was a doctor in AIDS back when we had no good treatment for it. Most of my patients have gotten their AIDS from dirty needles. As I went on and things began to change with HIV, I became interested in the drug use issues themselves and took jobs at a methadone clinic and then finally at the Harm Reduction Coalition, where my main work is preventing deaths from overdose, because that is a huge killer of people that use and misuse drugs.
So You know, that brings up an interesting thing. We're going to be talking about naloxone today, which is a preventative, you know, overdose measure, and we'll get into kind of the details of naloxone. But a lot of people reared up and resisted a clean needle exchange back in the day. Wouldn't you agree?
They certainly did, but I think we've got plenty of data and proof now that, that clean needles not only prevent HIV and hepatitis, they provide a window back to many health-promoting institutions, whether it be medical care, drug treatment, housing. So I think, I hope that most people are beginning to realize that this is part of community and public health. Unfortunately, we still have the federal ban on being able to give out needles. But there's plenty of needle exchanges, not enough going on, but there is more and more needle access going on now.
And that kind of plays into, go ahead, Whitney, you have a comment on that?
I would just note that it's ironically because of that resistance and some illegal barriers at the federal level and state level paraphernalia laws, ironically because of that, we have had just an incredible amount of research and data to look at the efficacy of these programs. So ironically, because of the resistance, we have decades worth of irrefutable scientific evidence showing not only the evidence base of the dramatic reductions of HIV and prevention of other health harms such as, you know, abscesses, infections, sepsis, endocarditis, other very expensive health problems, but also that these participants are five times more likely to enter drug treatment than non-participants in these programs. So that's very significant, as Dr. Stanquist was saying. This is absolutely about saving lives, preventing infectious disease, but what has been so incredible about these programs is their strong linkages to drug treatment and their transforming of a community into a recovery-based community.
I think in everybody's wildest hopes when they first put needle exchange on the chalkboard and the controversy that followed it, I don't think there's any way in the world that people would have thought it would have been this successful statistically to prove to us that this was a very much needed program. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
Countries that started it sooner have had very little HIV among their injection drug users, and New York is an incredible example of decreasing over HIV rates over the course of instituting needle exchange.
And you're both from New York, except I'm sorry, Whitney, you're in L.A. now, correct?
I am, so
right.
I'm bi-coastal.
Yeah, and you've been all over the place, Whitney, Oregon, and all those places. But New York, you know, I was going to touch on this. I'm so proud of New York that I'm out in California, but New York is really cutting edge on helping this. You have a great advocate in Avi Israel. I assume you both know who he is. And he has done so much, and so many people have gotten together, and your politicians have gotten together and crossed the party lines and made things happen. And I just wish we had the same level of cooperation out in California, and maybe someday we will. But I just want to give a shout out to New York for all that you guys are doing in helping to raise awareness, education, and the reform in New York State is amazing to me.
Well, thank you, and I want to acknowledge our health departments in leading a lot of that, as well as my own agency and several others like the Drug Policy Alliance.
Well, great. So let me ask you this. We're going to talk about naloxone today. So without any further ado, we'll start with Whitney. Tell us, what do you know about naloxone and how it works?
Well, you know, this may actually be the best question for Dr. Stanquist.
Well, naloxone, when somebody takes heroin or OxyContin, it goes on to receptors in the brain, in the gut, all over the body, and it turns on those receptors. When you give somebody naloxone, it goes to those receptors, figuratively speaking, pushes the heroin, pushes the oxy off of the receptor, and sits on that receptor, blocking it for 30 to 90 minutes. So all the effects of the opiate go away. Pain relief goes away. The most important thing we're talking about is the respiratory depression goes away. The person begins to breathe again. It's not a pleasant experience, though, because if pain was there, the pain is back. If they are dependent on opiates, they will go into some level of withdrawal. But this window of 30 to 90 minutes is enough time, certainly, to call an ambulance. And if people are afraid to call an ambulance, in most cases, the vast majority of cases, it's plenty of time to save a life. It's also an extremely safe medicine. If somebody has not taken an opiate, it has absolutely no effect. So there's really no downside to it. Here in this country, it remains a prescription medication, but Italy made it over-the-counter in the late 1980s, basically to prevent overdose deaths among illicit drug users.
And how is it used now? Is it prescription-based, so it's in ambulances and things like that?
Well, for many years, it was invented in the 60s. It's been found in emergency rooms, and then it moved into ambulances. They realized it could be used by the professionals that are not in the medical setting, the ambulance folks. And then since the late 90s, and really increasingly since the beginning of the 2000s, we have been putting it into the hands of people that are likely to witness an overdose, whether it be a drug user, the parent of a drug user, a police officer, a fireman. We're beginning to get it out into the community so people can get access to it really quickly.
So down to the bare bones of it, if I'm the father of a drug abuser and I know they're an opiate addict, whether it's heroin or Oxycontin or something like that, can I get a prescription for that and have it around in case I walk in the room and find my child unconscious?
At this time,
depends on where you live.
Exactly. You want to go with that, Whitney?
Yes.
Yeah, Whitney, go with the legal side of this and the, let's just say, the lawmaker side of this. Why is it dependent on where I live? Why can some people get this and have it around to save their children while other states cannot?
Well, I'll just say that it is a prescription medication. So anywhere in the U.S., you should be able to, the person with an addiction should be able to go to the person at risk of an overdose, should be able to go to their doctor and get a prescription for the naloxone. Where the barrier comes is because, just like if somebody is suffering from cardiac arrest or more commonly from an allergic reaction, when you are suffering from an overdose, you are not able to administer it yourself. So we actually, what we want to do, and again, as Dr. Stanford said, because of the extreme safety profile of this medication, you know, again, there's no abuse potential. It's benign in individuals without opioids in their system, and there's no contraindications. So it's a very safe medication. Because of that profile, we realize that, you know, this is something that should be in every single medicine cabinet. So there can be a kind of a community protection that really we need this in the hands of those most likely to witness an overdose. But it's because of the nature, just as you've seen a lot of barriers related to EpiPen legislation, there's often a need to allow for third-party administration of the drug, protections essentially for both the prescribing physician and for the person administering the drug. Now, I say this, but at the same time, I would note that, as far as I know, and Dr. Stanclough, you can correct me, I don't think it's ever happened, and if it's happened, it's extraordinarily rare that somebody would actually be sued, which is what the protection is against, but the issue comes with both patient behavior and provider behavior.
So if I were to be injected with naloxone and I wasn't on opiates, what would happen to me?
Absolutely nothing.
So it would just be like, I don't know, saline or something like that in my system?
Absolutely nothing. That's correct.
Right. Now, back to where you might be able to get it. You are in California, which is an interesting state. Some counties in California... A person like yourself could be prescribed it if you knew somebody at risk of overdose. In other counties, it can't. This is changing quickly, though. I believe there's legislation on the table in California to allow everybody to be able to receive it if they might witness an overdose. And at this time, we have, I believe, 14 states and Washington, D.C. that specifically allow anyone who might witness an overdose to carry and use naloxone. Six of those states passed the legislation this year, 2013. Mm-hmm. So this is becoming more and more common. I mean, it ranges from New York, which, of course, is liberal, to Kentucky, which is not known for being liberal. And, you know, hopefully we'll talk. Whitney is great at giving instructions for how to begin to advocate for this.
Well, in Kentucky or any state, honestly, you know, I interview people all over the United States, and it never ceases to amaze me. And granted, Kentucky became a bit of a poster child for opiate abuse and coming out of Florida, and Florida, of course, became a poster child for providing those opiates. But at the same time, everywhere that I interview somebody, it doesn't matter if they live in small town, you know, South Dakota, they have addiction around them. They are afflicted by addiction. And this is something that I'm surprised that it's taken this long, but I'm glad to see a wave of approvals coming in, because you're right, it starts to add up. So,
well, in the past, you know, we work a lot with, you know, I primarily work at the federal level and work with congressional offices. And when we meet with some of these districts, which are very varied from New Mexico to West Virginia, people are desperate for solutions. And in hard-hit communities, they need a tremendous amount of help. So to be able to provide an answer and an opportunity and a way for folks to somehow save the people that they love in their community, they're willing to do. They're ready, and they need to implement this immediately.
Well, the examples of where naloxone would have saved lives are so vast that it's shocking to me that it's not happening quicker, but I'm glad that you guys are out there beating the drum. Don't you, how many examples do you see on a percentage wire? Do you have numbers on how many people might be saved if naloxone was federally made legal across the United States to be put in the hands of people that have addicts among them?
Well, I think I can give you some numbers of what we've seen so far. I haven't projected forth. But in 2010, my colleague at the Harm Reduction Coalition, Eliza Wheeler, surveyed all of the known naloxone programs across the country, whether the state-run ones, such as in New York and New Mexico, or underground ones that are just distributing very quietly to users and their family members. And she found that in 2010, that's a long time ago now, over 50,000 people had been trained and received naloxone, and 20% of them, over 10,000 people, had come back and said they had used their naloxone, potentially saving a life. Now, probably not all 10,000 people would have died, because not every overdose that looks like it might be fatal is, but I would say at least 1,000 or 2,000 people were saved. Plus, many other things happen when you have a near miss. People get pneumonia, they get nerve damage, they get brain damage.
Brain damage, right.
Yeah, so there's a huge amount of morbidity or illness that's prevented by this as well. That survey is going on again now, and so hopefully in a few months we'll be able to tell you much higher numbers. As I say, it's spread a lot since 2010.
Well, I'd love to hear about that. We're coming up on a break, and after the break I'd like to talk about, I mean, if federally we're not able to approve needles, how likely are we federally to approve naloxone? And in the long-range plan, does it matter, or do we just need to get it in their hands? We're coming up on a break. Let's talk about that when we get back. You're listening to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm joined by Whitney Englander and Dr. Sharon Stancliffe. I'm Bradley DeHaven. I'm your host on Afflicted by Addiction.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon, and if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Bradley DeHaven has spoken to thousands of parents and addicts, discovering commonalities and teachable moments that can spare you the consequences of addiction. The signs, symptoms, and solutions of drug addiction is something you can learn now or when you are forced to. Bradley has written 2 books on drug addiction from the view of a parent. His no BS approach could save your child's life. Brad has been interviewed on Fox, ABC, CBS, The Huffington Post, and other forms of media. Brad and his son appear in the award-winning documentary Behind the Orange Curtain. Brad's available as a keynote speaker for events and corporations. Learning about addiction is important for every family. All the rules have changed, and now the drugs that addict our children are synthetic heroin, prescribed by your doctor and found in your own medicine cabinet. Sign up for Brad's newsletter on rxdrugaddict.com and find links to his two books, Defining Moments and The Addict Among Us. Again, be sure to visit rxdrugaddict.com for more information.
Prescription drug and heroin use are epidemic in America. Every 19 minutes, someone dies from a drug overdose. Every 24 minutes, someone dies from a prescription drug overdose. Where do these drugs come from? Your own medicine cabinet, the middle school playground, friends, and the biggest problem of all, dirty doctors. Behind the Orange Curtain is a hard-hitting documentary that will open your eyes and your heart to this very real epidemic facing our youth today. Prescription drugs and heroin use. Addiction crosses all socio and economic barriers. It doesn't matter if you live on Park Avenue or the park bench, no one is exempt. It's in your city, your county, your state, and in your backyard. Behind the Orange Curtain is coming to iTunes April 23rd. Check out Behind the Orange Curtain on Facebook and visit our website at www.behindtheorangecurtain.net.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to brad@rxdrugaddict.com. That's brad@rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven. I'm joined today by two experts in the field of naloxone. We're talking about naloxone as how it reverses the effects of overdose. I'm joined by Whitney Englander and Dr. Sharon Stancliffe. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So when we left on the break, we were talking about, you know, the lack of federal approval for the needle exchange and kind of working that into, you know, what the odds would be of getting a federal approval for the naloxone. What are your thoughts on that, doctor?
Well, I work primarily at the federal level, and there is an incredible amount of support. I would just make one clarification, which is that syringe exchange is not illegal at the federal level. What there is no federal money flowing to syringe services. So they can't make it illegal because it's the federal government doesn't have the authority to do that. But when it comes to the support specifically for overdose prevention, education, and naloxone distribution, the federal government is extremely supportive. It falls within a greater context of, I think, issues of coordination at the federal level because of the multi-jurisdictional nature of prescription drug abuse and overdose. It doesn't fall neatly into one bureaucracy. So because of that, it takes a vast amount of coordination among agencies. Crudely speaking, it requires people to come and bring their checkbook. And as we know, working across these agency jurisdictional lines is always challenging. So the issue of prescription drug abuse in general, overdose in general, and of course, naloxone distribution faces those same challenges. However, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which sets the agenda for both supply reduction and demand reduction strategies in the United States is extremely supportive. It was highlighted in this most recent national drug control strategy by President Obama and Director Kerlikowske, where even in the preface of the strategy, immediately second paragraph was the example of a wonderful program in North Carolina called Project Lazarus, which distributes naloxone. Reinforced throughout the document was support for naloxone distribution. In addition to that, again, dealing with the challenges that overdose in general is not housed within a specific agency. It's injury prevention. It's substance abuse. It's our Health and Human Services at the Assistant Secretary of Health level, the Surgeon General, because overdose isn't housed in a specific area. That's why we don't see the strong portfolio dedicated to naloxone. However, there is a great groundswell of support to change that. I would say that there's, we convened, the Harm Reduction Coalition convened a wonderful loose coalition of public health organizations, which include drug prevention, treatment, mental health, maternal and child health, and all of the leading medical societies all committed to promoting this intervention, and we've had great success. So I think I can't say too much at this moment because the bill hasn't dropped yet, but we are going to start seeing specifically federal legislation which authorizes programming related to naloxone distribution. And then I will say that 2 years in a row, our organization has been successful in getting language inserted into major spending bills, the appropriate spending bill, that would encourages the use of federal dollars to flow to naloxone distribution. The only reason why is that why we have not been able to actually implement the programming has been because we are living in very unique political times where we aren't passing bills, but it has nothing to do with the naloxone.
No, we aren't passing much, are we?
No.
So when we look at an individual community that's embraced naloxone, its distribution, it's getting out there into the hands of the people who are surrounded by people that might potentially overdose and into those that might overdose themselves, do you have a poster child of a place that has really collected a lot of data and a lot of information? Because I know you can implement something somewhere, but some places are better than others of giving you all the data back that you need to really see if it's working and where its weaknesses are. Do you have a particular example of a community or, place in the United States that did that?
Yes, I am really pleased with the work they've done in Massachusetts. Massachusetts implemented overdose prevention after some other states and was able to learn some lessons. And they are able to, even though it's prescription medication, have it given out by specially trained non-medical people, which is a huge step in the right direction. And I believe other states are learning that lesson. And they've also been able, as they implemented across the state, been able to collect data. So they started in Boston, and the Boston program went very well. Massachusetts has a huge problem with heroin overdose, so relatively quickly they began implementing it in towns with high overdose rates. But it's hard to do overnight. It takes some time to get these things done. So they collected data over time and then went back to look at it over the course of, I believe, 2 to 3 years. And what they found was that in towns with more than 100 per 100,000 people carrying naloxone, overdose rates dropped by about 47%.
Wow.
In towns with less, with some naloxone, but less than 100 people per 100,000, overdose rates dropped by, I should have it in front of me, I believe 27% or 23%. Mm-hmm. So and they were able to control for the number of people that were using opiates, number of people doctor shopping, how much treatment was available. It's very, very rigorous data. And so I think that's very strong proof that naloxone in the community, the more the better, the more lives that we save. So, I think that's part of what's allowing it to move ahead is that we're really getting some very strong data. That being said, most of the places that institute naloxone have had decreases or flattening of overdose rates while the rest of the country has still been going up. So this is strong enough that really the federal government has something to look at, and it's even being looked at internationally at this time.
Well, they certainly do have a lot of data to look at, and the proof is there in these. You have to go out and do test areas or whatever the case may be to give them that data so that they can evaluate it and say, yeah, this is needed or this isn't needed. But 47% reduction in overdoses in that one area is enormous.
Several areas, yeah.
Yeah,
several different towns. So the towns with a lot of naloxone did better than the towns with a little bit of naloxone who did better than the towns with no naloxone.
I'd like each of you to tell me, if you know, an actual human story, a story about how this worked for a family or an addict or a situation like that. Do each of you have a story like that?
Oh, I have so many, but I'll choose one.
Okay. And who do we have now?
Go ahead, Sharon.
Is this Whitney or Sharon?
Okay, I'll go ahead. This is Sharon.
Okay,
and
Dr. Stancliffe. Okay.
One of the things that we've been doing in New York, which I'm very proud of, is that we have been working with a variety of types of agencies, both our syringe exchange programs, of course, but drug treatment programs, clinics, shelters, in instituting naloxone in these various settings. And I'd like to tell a little story about an experience in drug treatment, because some of your listeners may have questions about how do you give naloxone in drug treatment? Isn't that telling people they're going to relapse? But we know some people are going to relapse, and it tells them that we want them to be safe even if they do. But even more than that, since we have third-party administration, we're able to tell people we know you're going back to the community, and we know you may be trying to avoid people, places, and things, but that's hard. And we believe that you are a good citizen, that you can save a life out there. And I think that's very reaffirming of any kind of recovery. So our addiction, actually our offices of alcohol and substance abuse treatment have been very supportive, and in one of their addiction treatment centers, a place where one goes for 28 days for recovery, the doctor there began to do it, and he loved doing the groups and giving out the naloxone. And he at one point had somebody come back to him, somebody that had relapsed in the community, came back into treatment and said, "Doc, I used the kit. I was using with my friend and we didn't want anybody to know we were in the house, and my friend overdosed. So to avoid his mother, I climbed out the window, got my naloxone kit, came in, and reversed his overdose. He started breathing again. He's not speaking to me anymore because it was such an unpleasant experience. But that made me realize I need to come back into treatment. I'm going to try harder this time."
Wow.
So, and there's more and more stories like that, but we won't take up the whole hour with that.
No, that's all right. I mean, human stories are important. The people that are listening to this are all across. They're in varying stages of either they've got an addict in their life, or they've got somebody in recovery, or they've lost a child to this. And when you have somebody in recovery, you know, I've interviewed addicts and I've interviewed, you know, parents, and I was a parent of a son who was an addict for many years, and on the 13th of September, it will be 3 years clean and sober, and I'm so very proud of him. But I also know that when they come out of rehab, we parents look at them with that one eye, and every little move they make makes us think, oh, my God, is it happening again, if they have a bad day or whatever the case may be. But as a parent, had I known that I could have had this, you know, drug available to reverse the symptoms of finding my son unconscious, as so many people have described to me that they have found their children in that way, and they've lost them. If I would have had that available, as you said early in the show, if it was in every home, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I interviewed someone for last week's show, and, you know, she was prepared, but she wasn't prepared that her son overdosed at her grandmother's house. Her grandmother wasn't prepared for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
so
very painful sometimes to realize that there was something that could have saved a life. That's very
absolutely is very painful. And I interview these people all the time, but I always tell them I will never, hopefully, know how you feel, you know, in reality. But to bury a child is just, and to know that there's a drug out there that we just need to chip away at some legalities, or perhaps have more education and awareness out there for these parents to get that drug in those homes, I think is huge. Whitney, tell me if you have a story that kind of touched your heart. Talk to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just say, too, that as we know, when patients are leaving treatment or any sustained period of abstinence, they're at extreme risk of overdose. And I think that, we have seen many, heartbreaking stories recently of the Glee star. And there's, you know, the data in terms of risk related to overdose post-abstinence, a long period of abstinence, is really scary. So this is, as you say, this is about saving lives. There is a wonderful program, as I mentioned before, Project Lazarus in North Carolina. It was this little county, rural conservative county in North Carolina that had one of the highest overdose rates in the nation. And they implemented a very wonderful naloxone distribution program, because many of the people that were overdosing there were not those necessarily with addiction, but it was very medically vulnerable. It was a very, you know, the population is the high labor and, you know, agriculture community, a lot of pain-related patients. So anyone who received a certain amount of opioid prescription also went home with a prescription of naloxone. And because of that, much like the Massachusetts experience, what it started to do is accumulate that naloxone was in medicine cabinets. So this was a story of a brother who was in a program, was in the program and had received naloxone, and he lived next door apparently to his neighbor. And what had happened is that the neighbor's teenage daughter had overdosed, and the family had called emergency services. Well, it wasn't an ambulance that arrived. It was an EMT. And the EMT actually did not have naloxone on hand. But what they found out was through that the neighbor may have been enrolled in this program. So they called the program. The program director said, yes, this is your neighbor, and I believe they have naloxone. The EMT worker actually walked next door, got to the naloxone, came back, and revived the young lady.
Wow.
So this is, you know, these profound stories. If I believe correctly, I don't want to state incorrectly, but I believe she entered drug treatment after that experience as well.
Well, and I think that, as you mentioned, this in drug treatment is so important because when people do come out, as we know, they are, you know, so vulnerable to go back to the same level of drugs they were once abusing, and so often they do, and a lot of overdoses happen in that period of time. My own cousin, last April 2012, had been clean for, as far as we know, years, and overdosed at his sister's child's birthday party in the bathroom, and naloxone probably would have saved his life. They were right there, but they couldn't get anybody to him, and by the time they did, he was gone. And so many stories are like that out there. So many parents I know that unfortunately, you know, their kids come home bouncing off the walls. They tell them to go sleep it off, and they just don't wake up. And nobody really knows what to do. But I think that's a great program to kind of piggyback the prescription of an opiate drug along with naloxone and have that available there. And like you said, it seems to kind of slowly seep into the medicine cabinets, hopefully, you know, not getting used, but there. It's amazing that they were able to have the time. It shows you the power of this drug. If you have the time to get an EMT there, find out who's got it, call somebody, and even go next door and get it and still save a life is amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, a couple of things I'd like to underline with that. Overdoses usually do happen slowly. People slowly forget to breathe, essentially. So as long as there's somebody there and they know what to do, there's time to do something. The sooner the better, of course, but there is some time to do something. And I also want to add that rescue breathing, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, even in the absence of naloxone, can save lives. If you can keep oxygen flowing, it appears that alone will save a life, and I really want to emphasize that because we don't have naloxone in every cabinet yet.
Absolutely, and that's great advice.
I would like to emphasize as well is that, you know, the naloxone is really the key piece, and that's what, you know, evicts those opioids from the opioid receptors and can restore breathing. But this is about a spectrum of responses, and we have a lot of information about how heart attack feels or how to avoid a fall or to use your seatbelt. And what we don't have a lot about are messages about how to recognize the signs and symptoms of an overdose and how you should respond. And just as Dr. Stanquist said, the importance of rescue breathing, there's been kind of a movement to restore just chest compressions to deal with heart attack and other issues. So I think it's important that we really advocate and we stay strong, saying we need specific messages about what the risks of overdose are, how you can prevent it, and how to recognize it. Because, as you say, there's too many tragedies where own parents put their own children to bed at night, not seeing the signs.
Right.
This is vital information that I believe we have an absolute imperative to get disseminated in the whole nation.
Well, it shows you that we need all three. We need awareness, we need education, and we need reform to tackle this epidemic that is sweeping so many of loved ones, not just children, but our loved ones, into an early grave. And, you know, it's always devastating to lose somebody, but with the parents that I talk to that won't hug their child again, that won't hear Happy Mother's Day again, that the saddest day of the year is now Mother's Day. And these things can be prevented by education, awareness, education, and reform. And that's one of the reasons we're here on Afflicted by Addiction, is to hopefully educate people about something called naloxone. Hopefully somebody out there is listening and saying, I've never heard of such a thing, and my child is an addict or a recovering addict, and or my brother is, or my loved one. And that's really the key here. And so that's why I'm so glad that you two are joining us today. We are coming up on a break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about how are we going to get this into some more of our communities? How are we going to have some Project Lazarus success stories? And let's talk about that when we get back from the break. You're listening to Afflicted by Addiction, and I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Bradley DeHaven has spoken to thousands of parents and addicts, discovering commonalities and teachable moments that can spare you the consequences of addiction. The signs, symptoms, and solutions of drug addiction is something you can learn now, or when you are forced to. Bradley has written two books on drug addiction from the view of a parent. His no BS approach could save your child's life. Brad has been interviewed on Fox, ABC, CBS, The Huffington Post, and other forms of media. Brad and his son appear in the award-winning documentary Behind the Orange Curtain. Brad's available as a keynote speaker for events and corporations. Learning about addiction is important for every family. All the rules have changed, and now the drugs that addict our children are synthetic heroin, prescribed by your doctor and found in your own medicine cabinet. Sign up for Brad's newsletter on rxdrugaddict.com and find links to his two books, Defining Moments and The Addict Among Us. Again, be sure to visit rxdrugaddict.com for more information.
Prescription drug and heroin use are epidemic in America. Every 19 minutes, someone dies from a drug overdose. Every 24 minutes, someone dies from a prescription drug overdose. Where do these drugs come from? Your own medicine cabinet, the middle school playground, friends, and the biggest problem of all, dirty doctors. Behind the Orange Curtain is a hard-hitting documentary that will open your eyes and your heart to this very real epidemic facing our youth today. Prescription drugs and heroin use. Addiction crosses all socio and economic barriers. It doesn't matter if you live on Park Avenue or the park bench. No one is exempt. It's in your city, your county, your state, and in your backyard. Behind the Orange Curtain is coming to iTunes April 23rd. Check out Behind the Orange Curtain on Facebook and visit our website at www.behindtheorangecurtain.net.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon. And if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to brad@rxdrugaddict.com. That's brad@rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you'd like to reach me, you can do so at rxdrugaddict.com. And I would love it if you have an idea for a future guest on the show. The show is America's Voice. We want to hear from people who have stories about recovery and hope and stories that really illustrate how this can happen to any family. Addicts that want to give me the keys to the kingdom, which I've had a couple of great interviews with them, and professionals and politicians and professionals like we've got with us today, like Whitney Englander and Dr. Sharon Stancliffe. Welcome back, ladies.
Thank you.
So before we left to the break, one of the things I'd like to talk about is that I deal with a lot of people. My son actually was never on a maintenance medication like Suboxone or methadone. He went cold turkey, went through rehab for months and months, and worked it out that way and doesn't so much as take an aspirin anymore. But it is not at all frowned upon by the medical community, and so many people are on maintenance drugs to help them curb the appetite for the opiates like Suboxone and methadone. And tell me, is this a good fit for naloxone? If somebody's on a maintenance medication like that, would this help them if they went overboard?
Well, let me start by saying that maintenance medication really protects people against overdose. They're half as likely to die and far less likely, if they do die, to die of an overdose than people not in treatment. And I think we really need to keep that in mind when we're seeing people overdose more than once. Having an overdose seems to be a risk for having another potentially fatal overdose. So if we're looking at people with relapses, with overdoses, please think about having them be on buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone, or methadone. It protects against overdose, and it does many good things for their lives, partly because it stops them from using other drugs, but also if they do use other drugs, they don't lose that tolerance. They're never without the opiate to keep their tolerance up. That being said, yes, methadone patients should have access to naloxone. They don't overdose often, but if they mix their methadone with a lot of benzodiazepines or alcohol, they're at risk of overdose, and naloxone works very well on methadone. Buprenorphine or Suboxone is very hard to overdose on because it's a partial agonist. It only partly turns on the receptors, so it's sort of half like naloxone and half like methadone. If people do overdose on it, it's usually because they've mixed it with other drugs. Naloxone does work, but you need a lot of naloxone. So, again, it's unlikely to overdose, and in fact, many drug users I know have realized, wow, if I take buprenorphine when I'm not in withdrawal, I go into withdrawal. So, wow, my friend is overdosing. I'm going to get some buprenorphine or Suboxone in him because it's going to put him into withdrawal. He'll breathe again. So it's interesting that drug users have figured out that use for it. I hope that kind of answers your question there.
Well, I think the drug users have figured out a lot of things, and I think, you know, one of the questions I'd like to propose to both of you is that we've got these medications out there that are coming out of, you know, the hands of doctors, and Dr. Stancliffe is obviously a doctor, but I think that these drugs, that the drug dealers or drug addicts figured out, hey, I'm not going to swallow this pill. I'm going to crush it, snort it, smoke it. And I think a lot of measures have come into place to help curtail that type of, you know, abuse of crushing, snorting, smoking some of these pills. But do either of you have an opinion on where Big Pharma sits with all this? Are they culpable? Should they mitigate the damages that their product caused to, you know, these families in our country?
I would love to see more action from the pharmaceutical companies, especially those that produce opioid medications, because one of the barriers to widespread naloxone access and utilization is the fact that this is a very old drug. It's been around for almost 50 years. It's a generic medication, and it's also a sterile medication, and it fits into this wider class of drugs, which are facing drug shortages and extreme price hikes across the nation. So there's been a lot of talk on a national debate. There's, you know, pediatric cancer drugs that are in low supply or no supply because they're generic and there isn't the strong financial incentive to produce them. So there's right now one manufacturer of naloxone. And it's really important, I think, for as a community, as a nation, that we support the widespread production of this drug. One of the barriers we haven't discussed is just price and funding. And that's one of the most important things a federal government can do or a state government can do, which is to actually support the actual purchase of the drug and the distribution of the drug to people who need it. So I would love to see pharmaceutical companies take this up, recognize that they have a moral imperative in order to create greater access to this life-saving drug, and to actually produce it and to sell it at a price that is affordable.
What does naloxone sell for?
Yeah. Formulations of naloxone, one of which is the less expensive one, which sells for somewhere between about $1.50 to $8 a dose, depending on access to it, which in the world of medicines is cheap, but that can be expensive when you're looking at getting into every medicine cabinet. The other formulation of it that we use, that one is used for injection. The other one that we use for administration via intranasal costs about $20 a dose. And again, in the world of medicine, that's not a lot of money, but getting it out there is hard. When we give out naloxone, we usually give two doses because we don't want to give one huge dose. We don't want people to go into such withdrawal that they become angry. So each kit tends to include two smaller doses. So kits range from about $20 to about $45 or $50.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the angry. I talked with a paramedic who had administered naloxone multiple times, mm-hmm. and he said that that is their biggest problem is when, after they administer it to an addict that is overdosed, is the level of anger that when they awake, basically, that they are irate. And why is that?
They were, the last they knew, they were very high and happy, and now suddenly they're actually, if they have, now, the people that have relapsed don't get quite so angry, but the people that are dependent wake up, and they are drug sick. If you give them too much naloxone, it can be a little dangerous because they might wake up vomiting. Most, if you talk to your paramedic friend, you'll probably find that in the old days he gave a larger dose, and now he's learned to start with a smaller dose.
Interesting.
So that's how, part of why we choose the doses that we do. We don't want people to wake up vomiting. We don't want them to wake up combative. And we really have not had any reports of that. We have less reports of that than paramedics do.
So,
yeah.
I
would just belies the misnomer that, you know, people, you know, overdose kind of, you know, with laissez-faire, and that it's not a big event in their life if they have naloxone. You know, it just drives home the point that overdoses are fatal. They're forever. You lose your life forever. And when somebody is revived, this is not just an experience you kind of walk off. This can be a life-changing, you know, moment of clarity for people. This is not a fun experience. You are not allowing greater drug use by giving this drug. You are providing an opportunity to live, and it is often the opportunity that will change people's lives forever.
Yeah, I don't think that that's the case.
Yeah. One person described it to me as only slightly better than death.
Well, you know, we are dealing with addiction, and addiction changes all the rules, and that's one of the problems with the education level at this, the, you know, community events and schools, is that people just, A, don't think it's ever going to happen to their kid. They see it happening somewhere else, and B, they really just don't understand what this will cause their wonderful little child to become. Out of necessity, you know, whether it's becoming a first-class liar or selling or stealing their furniture and jewelry or selling themselves on the street, it causes people to do deep and dark things. So them being upset when you revive them out of a possible, you know, what could have been their last day is not surprising to me, but it is surprising to some parents.
And many say thank you the next day. I do want to give them that.
Okay, good. You get a thank you card afterwards.
Right.
So what can people do at a state level to help bring naloxone? And by the way, naloxone is known as what else?
Narcan.
Narcan. So a lot of people, that's kind of the Kleenex name for facial tissues, is
right.
Narcan. So what can people do to get Narcan or naloxone into their communities? Is there something that they can do at the state level? And who would like to share with me there? How about Whitney to start with?
Sure. I can start with what folks can do on a legislative level, and I think Dr. Stancliffe can do a great job of how you can kind of work with your local general practitioners in a community. But the biggest thing I think parents and advocates need to know is that their voices do matter. Their legislators, whether they're, you know, assembly member representatives or whether it's their congressional representatives, they want to hear from them and they have a voice. So I would say anybody who is interested in pursuing, you know, removing legal barriers at the state level should definitely be seeking out who represents them in assembly and who represents them in Senate, and just to go in and meet with their staff and to talk about that. Additionally, I would say it really does matter, too, at the federal level. Phone calls into your senator or to your House representative matter. Phone calls, letters, pester them. It does make a difference.
Yeah, that's something I've really learned from working with Whitney as an advocate. It does make a difference. I would also say call your local health departments and ask about it. And I also want to put in a plug for at least our website, because there is naloxone available in a number of states, so harmreduction.org, and there's a link where you can put in a zip code and find out if there is naloxone nearby. There's links to the states that have developed legislation but haven't begun. So I agree with Whitney on calling the representatives. I think calling the health department, harm reduction agencies, and we have links to those, may already have it, whether or not it's passed in the state or not. And talk to your doctor. Talk with your doctor. Maybe he or she will write you a prescription. They're not likely to get sued if they write a prescription for something that you don't definitely need. There are some that are willing to stretch it. Oh, you received 5 Tylenol number 3 from your doctor? Well, you've got an opiate. I can give you a prescription.
Good.
So I think all different levels, it really needs to be approached. And I think, you know, on our website, you can also find some of the federal tools that are out there, the support of the White House Office on Drug Policy.
And that's harmreduction.org.
Exactly.
Okay. And there's an interactive little map there where if I punch in my zip code, I might find that it's available somewhere.
Yeah.
I would also just say, too, if we look at experiences across the nation of what parents have done in Massachusetts, there's a campaign going on in Minnesota, in Pennsylvania, all across the U.S., it's just normal people. It's people that have been affected by addiction, yet they are changing this in their own communities one little step at a time. So I would just note again that it's entirely possible, just working with your community members, if you know other parents that have either a child that has, you know, has overdosed or that is suffering from addiction, start there, because that synergy of the parents is really what's changing the whole entire landscape.
Great. Now we've got about a minute left. Let me start with Dr. Stancliffe. Dr. Stancliffe, final words of wisdom from you on naloxone. What can you share with our audience?
Well, I think that everybody that has somebody at risk in their life really should look and find out where they can get naloxone now, and if they can't get it easily, do it the hard way, but start advocating. And I think I just wanted to add also that this is an issue that crosses the aisle. This is the place that bipartisan things can happen. In New York State, this law passed unanimously. We have Republicans and Democrats on both sides, so go there and make it happen so we have less lives lost.
That's great. Whitney Englander, final words of wisdom, share with our audience.
I would just echo what Sharon says, which is that we have tremendous political power. Our representatives want to respond to this issue, and we have a responsibility to do so, that promoting public health evidence-based solutions to reducing the harms associated with drug use is the only way we're going to escape the non-ending cycle of drug abuse in this nation. We have to take a health-centered, public health evidence-based approach.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you both so much. Thank you, Whitney Englander, and thank you, Dr. Sharon Stancliffe, for sharing your important information on naloxone here on Afflicted by Addiction. Thanks again so much for being here. We'll be back next Tuesday on Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Please join Bradley DeHaven for another Afflicted by Addiction program on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll be back next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time. We'll talk more then.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.